convene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We are delighted to see you all, and I'll call the third case for today, 03AP1534 Royster Clark, Inc. v. Olson's Mill. Arguing on behalf of Olson's Mills is James D. Peoples. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. I'm attorney James D. Pebbles, arguing on behalf of Olson's Mill. Really, with this case, there's two issues that we're really looking at today. The first one, and this corresponds with the Court of Appeals decision, was there any evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding that there was an oral agreement to modify the written contract that's in question in this case? And secondly, even if there was such an agreement, can such a contract be modified orally? And the answer to both of those questions is yes. I'm not going to get into a lengthy recitation of the relevant facts of this case, but there are two points in the factual background that I would like to stress. First of all, is that there were two meetings between the parties. The first one was in June between Paul Olson, the representative of Olson's Mill, and with Roger Ralston, the sales agent for Royster Clark. That first meeting is June, and it's at that meeting that the trial court found that there was an oral agreement made to modify this contract. And also, to stress, after that meeting, Olson's Mill changed their position. They retracted their request for a rescission or buyout of that contract, and then started to pick up the product and try to sell it to their customers.
Counsel, in the record, you said you weren't going to go over it, but I just have a question. Your opposing counsel says that there is no evidence at any place that would lead any trier of fact to believe that there was an oral agreement to modify. Now, part of your brief was based on the fact that the appellate court did not use the entire proceedings. In other words, they did not, in a de novo fashion, look at the whole case. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And can you point out to me what part you feel is most important?
Well, specifically, I think the Court of Appeals, it appears, looked at particular snippets of Mr. Olson's testimony. I believe that when you look at Mr. Olson's testimony in its entirety, which includes the testimony about the long business relationship and past dealings with Royster Clark where a number of verbal agreements and changes to contracts had to be made because of the marketplace and the changing conditions, we believe that in and of itself can lead the trial court to a reasonable inference that there was an agreement made in this case.
Mr. Peebles, I'm having the same problem that Justice Wilcox is having. It's one thing to say looking at the testimony in its entirety or the evidence in its entirety, but where in the record can one find specific evidence to show that there was an oral agreement modifying the contract? I mean, don't just tell us look at the whole evidence. Where can we find that?
I think specifically we can find it in the transcript of Paul Olson's testimony when he was testifying about the original meeting with the sales agent in June. And his testimony was that he was seeking a buyout or some sort of rescission of that contract to get out from under that contract because the prices bottomed out of the product. And then directly after this meeting, Paul Olson changed his position and then started picking up the product and trying to get it out to his customers, trying to move the product as best he could.
But an agreement connotes two parties. What, if anything, did Ralston indicate the other party was going to do?
I believe also with Paul Olson's testimony, he testified that there were, they discussed the options would be either some free product in the future or to get a rebate on their fall purchase of the nitrogen product. And also, as the trial court found, that Roger Ralston's testimony, where in his years and years of being a sales agent for this, for Royster Clark, this was the only time one of his deals or representations he made to a customer was not backed up.
But I guess my question once again, an agreement connotes an offer and an acceptance. And to say that, well, maybe we'll give you a rebate or maybe we'll do this or maybe we'll do that, I'm trying to focus in on exactly where the agreement occurs. And if you could direct me to where that is.
It directly occurred at the June meeting with Roger Ralston and Paul Olson. Because after this discussion, that's where everything changed.
Right. So at that June meeting, what did Ralston indicate that they would do?
They indicated they would either give credit on the fall purchase or free product, depending on the situation in the future. And
did they indicate that he would see what he could do?
I believe that is it came out of the July meeting where Roger Ralston met with Paul Olson and Robert Rainey. That's where I think some of the confusion comes in, because at the July meeting, that's when it became known that some sort of other approval was needed. Paul Olson relied on the representations of Roger Ralston from the June meeting, as they had done in a number of times in the past, and which was common in this industry. It wasn't until this later meeting with the Roger Ralston supervisor, who Paul Olson did not even know who he was, he was new to the area. It wasn't until that meeting, after Paul Olson had already changed his position, that it became apparent that something more was needed.
What happened in between the two meetings?
Between the two meetings, Paul Olson then rescinded his request to get out of this contract, and he turned around and started sending his trucks down to pick up the remaining product. The original contract called for 2,000 tons of the fertilizer. Up to the June meeting, only about 700 tons was picked up, and Paul Olson, because of the market, was looking to see some way to get out of getting that remaining 1,300 ton. After this meeting, however, he did a complete 180, changed his position, and then started sending trucks almost every day to pick up the remaining product.
Now, he changed his position based on the representations of Mr. Ralston?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the part that you allege, at least in your brief, that the Court of Appeals, in fact, I think in their opinion, they said they did not review that part of the transcript. Mr. Ralston's testimony, is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. That's footnote number 7 of the Court of Appeals decision. And to that point specifically, in the trial court's memorandum decision specifically found that it came to its conclusion based on accepting Paul Olson's testimony and also indicated it accepted part of Roger Ralston's testimony. Specifically when they indicate that Mr. Ralston's testimony that this was the only time he's never been backed up by Royster Clark in his representations, the trial court came to the inference that assurances were made at that June meeting enough to rise to a verbal agreement.
I'm looking at the transcript, the testimony, I believe it's of the June meeting, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's in on page 100 of the appendix in your brief. And if I'm reading this wrong, tell me, correct me, but it says, my commitment to him this is Olson talking about Ralston, was that I would take and move the product to the farmer, and personally at this time it was going to simply be going out on the ground through your agent systems, and whatever price it was from what we purchased it to what we sold it to the farmer was that he was going to try to get a credit when we refilled in the fall of either material or price concession on the number of times we bought. Now, if that's the language that was used, that he was going to try, how does that connote an agreement?
I think when you look at and keep in mind the prior business dealings that these parties had, they've had a number of these types of discussions over the years. Approximately, Paulson testified, approximately 40 years he's been dealing with Royster Clark, and approximately 18 with Roger Ralston as local sales rep, both for Royster Clark and for other companies. Based on that long business relationship, we submit that this discussion and this agreement is no different than any other one they have entered into in the past. And based on that past business history, Paul Olson reasonably believed that they had an agreement. This is what it was going to be, and then he carried out his end of the bargain.
Well, is reasonably believe that there's an agreement the same thing as having an agreement? Now, the trial court, whose findings we either have to affirm or not, on page 8 of in your appendix, page 8, the trial court said, Olson was, this is relating to Roger Ralston's testimony, Olson was promised that Mr. Ralston would do his very best to obtain return consideration. That seems to be what Justice Butler has just read, and that's what the trial court said. He's going to do his very best. Then it gets to Paul Olson, and it says, Olson testified that Mr. Ralston made representations that if Olson took the nitrogen product off Royster's hands, Royster would give consideration by way of credit back on accounts or by way of delivery of free product. So there was no, seems from that, Royster was merely going to give consideration, had not made a deal yet. On page 10, the court said, Ralston had broad authority to negotiate and make deals. The court finds that the nitrogen contract was modified the second week of June 12th. It was on 1, and then on page 11, the court finds that Mr. Ralston had apparent authority to bind its principal. But Ralston's own testimony was he didn't say he was binding him. He just said he's going to try. Now, the fact that Ralston had been successful previously, somebody keeps telling me I'm going to try, and then they are successful. The next time they say try, I figure they're going to be successful, but I still know they're just trying. Now, it may be that, so from all of that, it would seem to me that the trial court found that, as it moved on, that Olson may have reasonably believed that the company was going to go ahead, but there was no binding agreement because Ralston kept saying, I'm going to try and get it through.
Well, I believe on page 8.
The conclusion that I would then draw is the same one as the Court of Appeals drew, namely, no agreement. They tried, but no agreement. Now, your job is to show me why I'm wrong. You have an uphill battle.
Well, I don't like hearing that, Your Honor, but...
okay, you have smooth sailing. How's that?
I think if you look at page 8 of the trial court's memorandum decision, the way this decision is formatted and constructed, what it is first, the trial court was giving a summary of what they testified to. It wasn't a specific finding that, yes, we believed that to be true. And if you turn to page 12, in the first full paragraph, this is where the trial court discusses Mr. Ralston's testimony when he answered the question, is it safe to say this is one of the first times that you have made representations to your customers that the company did not back you on? And his answer was, I think it was the only time. And the trial court specifically found here that this statement is inconsistent with his testimony that no assurances were made.
Except that Ralston's testimony that no assurances were made is exactly the same as Olson's testimony, which is that no assurances were made.
Well, I believe in Mr. Olson's testimony.
And it goes on to say it is consistent, I don't know what it refers to, with Mr. Olson's testimony.
I believe the trial court was referring to the statement by Mr. Ralston, which was
inconsistent. Okay, so Ralston's statement was that that they generally don't go back is consistent with Mr. Olson's, that they don't go back, but it's certainly the fact that there was a statement that both of them, one said, the other heard, that we need company approval, or words to that effect. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. And I think, you know, to properly characterize Mr. Ralston's testimony in this is not that generally they back me up, is that they have never failed to back me up before.
That was in response to a question, not what he told Olson. Did he tell Olson anywhere that they always back me up, not to worry?
I think that was inferred by the trial court based on the past business practices with the...
All right.
Counsel, I want you to look at page 101 of the appendix. I don't know if you have the transcript. It's in my, let's see, it's 130 from somebody's appendix. It is Olson's testimony at 101 of the transcript, which is, the transcript I had before me is in, it's reduced so you can have four pages on one page.
Yes.
Okay, and there's a question to Olson. I think also the court's asking, what was your agreement with the owner, with the property owners, the farmers? Well, we went out, and our goal was to move Rogers' product, and the commitment and whatever the price was, let's say the price at the farm was $140 a ton. We would sell it at the farm for $140, and the price difference between $140 and $192, or $52 a ton, was the difference. I told Roger then, you have to make up 10 cents on the product. I would haul it and eat this cost, which is about $20 a ton, but I didn't want to lose a penny on the nitrogen, so I didn't make a margin. But we needed to work through this, and that's what we did. Question. And this was through discussions and agreement you had with Roger also? Answer, yes. That, well, he didn't say yes. Answer, that was around the 10th, the middle of June. That testimony from Olson at least appears to me that he thought he had an agreement with Ralston on behalf of Royster Clark. And I don't, the trial court doesn't say or quote exactly the phrases that it's relying on. So, you know, as you can see, my colleagues have some concern about whether there was an agreement or whether there was an attempt to get an agreement.
I want to focus on, I'm sorry. Please respond, Justice Rosen.
No, and I don't think there's any question here, based on the whole history of this case, that Paul Olson was absolutely convinced there was an agreement. And this is based on a number of factors, based on the meeting he had with Roger Ralston in, around June 10th, and going back on their prior business history where they've had, you know, innumerable number of similar conversations and have in the past worked out a number of verbal contracts.
Now, it's obvious here, and I'm just following through with the on page 102, that after they had the discussion that that Ralston was apparently let go. I'm not sure whether it was because of this transaction, but he was let go because of the fact that Royster disagreed with his position. Is that correct?
Yes.
We don't know what.
Yeah, we don't. That's based on the timing and everything. We believe that this situation was one that led to Mr. Olson's dismissal.
But your point is that you're saying that the agreement, alleged agreement, that took place was the one that before Ralston intervened, before the supervisor intervened in this transaction, based on prior history.
Right. That is correct. And which is what the trial court specifically found, that the oral modification happened after the June meeting. After the July meeting between Robert Rainey, Roger Ralston, and Paul Olson, then it became clear that, you know, this agreement was not going to be upheld. And this was after Olson's Mill had already rescinded their request to get out of the contract and started picking up the rest of the product.
Of what weight, and I'm looking again at page 101 that we were just reviewing, of what weight do you give to the question and answer, lines 18, page 101? And this was through discussion and agreement with Roger also? That was the question. Answer. That was around the 10th, middle of June. What goes through my mind would be objection, Your Honor, non-responsive.
I mean, no objection.
You know, that is, that the answer doesn't respond to the question. Now, if there would have been some kind of an affirmative statement or, yeah, that's right, there was an agreement or, but it doesn't respond to the question. So in my mind, of what import do you give to this 18 through 20 portion of the transcript on page 101?
I think it's very reasonable to infer from that response, although it is not a definite, yes, this was the agreement, but it's an affirmation of from the question, and this was through discussions and agreement with Roger also. Inherent in that question is that you had an agreement with Roger Ralston, the sales agent.
Is it fair to say that maybe that's ambiguous? It could be interpreted in a couple of ways, or don't you think that that's ambiguous of a response?
I don't think it's ambiguous at all, because all of Olson's testimony is that we had an agreement. And this statement here on line 20 is that, yeah, we had the agreement. It was made about June 10th.
What about when you said all of Olson's testimony was that we had an agreement? What about the excerpts in the Court of Appeals opinion that the excerpts of Olson's testimony that they relied on to show that there wasn't an agreement? I mean, it can't be all of it. I mean, that's when Olson testified, quote, he believed, quote, he had an agreement with Ralston. Ralston, quote, was going to try to get a credit. Ralston, quote, was going to work to either give Olson Mills free product or reduce the price per ton of product. Ralston, quote, said he was going to work on the rebate and try to get it accomplished, unquote. Ralston promised he would attempt to, quote, work something out with regard to the product. But, I mean, it seems to me that those portions of the testimony are not conclusive that there was an agreement, rather that there's an argument as embraced by the Court of Appeals that they were rather showing that there was a promise rather than a done deal, promise to try rather than a done deal.
Well, I think the only ambiguity in Mr. Olson's answer is that the agreement, it didn't say you were getting free product. This is only you're getting, or you're just getting a rebate on your fall purchase. I think the ambiguity comes in and can be read that, you know, the question was, well, we're either getting free product or we're getting this. That's where the question comes in. Not
just which one.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying.
And,
Could you explain, in terms of the practices in the industry, if Mr. Olson hadn't thought there was an agreement, what would he have done? I mean, he's ordered 2,000 tons. He's gotten 700 of them. But I understood that he had paid the whole bill for all 2,000. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. What would he have done? I mean, what bargaining power does he have?
Well, and that ties into what the trial court found specifically, in that in the course of this whole situation, the trial court specifically found that Royster Clark acted in bad faith in this as well. What Olson did, what a number of people in the industry did, is when the bottom fell out of the price of this product, they were going back and trying to get rebates, get some of their money back, or cancel contracts. He did what everyone else was doing, trying to protect himself from, you know, taking that, you know, anywhere between $70 to $80 loss per ton. And that's what he initially went there in June to discuss with Mr. Ralston, and how they could, you know, if they could work something out to get out of that contract. And then they changed their position. Instead of seeking that buyout or some way to rescind the contract and not get the remaining tonnage, they turned around, completely reversed their position, and then went and picked up the remainder of the product and put it out to the customers for whatever price they could get.
Mr. Peebles, I understand that you disagree strongly with the opinion of the Court of Appeals in this matter, and I think that comes through loud and clear in your brief. But I guess what I want to focus on is, what important principle of law are we dealing with in this case here today, or is this merely a question of error correction?
Well, when I think this is coming in, it's principles of, you know, broad principles of fair dealing and equity, and recognizing that, you know, the universal Uniform Commercial Code, which governs these transactions, in the first section of the UCC, it states that the purpose of the UCC is to promote fair dealing and promote better business, in summary, and that the provisions of this section should be liberally construed to further those goals. And I think one of the key points of this was the trial court finding that Royster Clark did act in bad faith during this whole transaction, which, and one of the specified goals of the UCC, one of the overriding goals for any sort of contract for the sales of goods or anything else falling under the UCC, is that the actors in it act in good faith and there's fair dealing. I believe that is a key portion as well, not to reward someone for their bad faith conduct.
How did they act in bad faith? They had a contract. They were paid. They were willing to deliver the fertilizer. How did they act in bad faith?
Well, I think, and this relates back down to the trial court, who is more familiar with the parties, is in the county, is familiar with the situation. The trial court recognizes that Royster, when they canceled all their pre-existing contracts in December of 2000, and then made everyone come in with the prepay contracts, where you buy all the product at this price up front, was not wrongful, but is, you know, evidence that they weren't dealing in good faith. And also the trial court referred to answers in the pleadings to the counterclaim, denials of certain claims and allegations made by Olson's Mill during the start of this action. And I think specifically Robert Rainey's testimony, and again their answers, were not straightforward. And I think that carried over into the trial level, as the court mentions on pages 13 to 14 of the memorandum decision. Their denials of that, one thing in particular, that Olson's Mill could have picked up the entire product at any time, when you had both Paul Olson and Roger Olson testifying that they could not accommodate that one big pickup. They were trying to parcel out to everyone so nobody got shorted. And their ongoing contention that the June 30th contract date for this contract to be completed was only referencing Roaster's desire to get the product out of their storage bins to get it moved, and that had no effect on Olson. Whereas, as the court, especially in Washera County, with a lot of rural and farming activity up there, is aware that June 30th is a very real date in the planting season. That is more or less a cutoff date. After that, this fertilizer is not going to be used for anything. I'll stop hitting that as well. Is not going to be used for planting for that year. So, correspondingly, the prices drop out. So, Roaster's denial that this was, an important date, it was only important to them, was a denial of reality. And all of this put together, the trial court found that it contributed to their determination that Roaster acted in bad faith.
Thank you, Mr. Peebles. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Hamill, representing Roaster Clark, Inc.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'd like to clear up a few things before I get into the basics of my argument. Mr. Ralston was not let go of Royster Clark based on this incident. There was actually another incident that occurred with respect to his employment that caused his termination. This is not the reason why he was let go.
None of this is in the record.
Okay. Thank you. And it is not part of that. The central issues, as I see it, are much like Attorney Peebles has said. However, I take a bit of a different perception on what the issue is with respect to the law. I don't think the question is whether an oral contract can be, or a written contract can be modified by an oral agreement. I think it is whether, in this case, it has been modified by an oral agreement, and I think that it has not. I'd also
that was a finding of fact by the trial court. And then the trial court even put finding of fact or the word fact in bold so it wouldn't slide by somebody's perception and think it was a conclusion of law. Do you agree that is a finding of fact on whether or not there has been an oral modification of a written contract?
I think the court said that there was. I think that was part of their the judge's explanation of where he came up with this agreement. I think that he may not state in there particularly that the written agreement was modified by an oral agreement, but that is his basis, yes.
Now, I guess my question was a little different. Is it a finding of fact for the trial court to say the contract was modified orally, or is it a conclusion of law for the trial court to say the contract was modified orally?
I think it's more of a conclusion of law, and we argue that in the brief that really this is a legal issue of how to interpret 402-209 of the Wisconsin statutes, and that would be a legal issue as to whether that oral agreement amounted to the type of thing that would be a waiver under that statute. I also, with respect to the record, and as I cited in the brief, I was looking for anything in the initial appeal of this case that would show that Mr. Olson actually said there was an agreement to the contrary of Mr. Ralston and of Royster Clark. I found nothing in the brief, no quotes, nothing that said there was an actual agreement even on Mr. Olson's behalf.
Also, I want you to look at page 101 that I was reading before.
It's 101 of Olson's testimony. It's a trial transcript. And it's the page that at the bottom is numbered 103 from an appendix. I don't know whose it is because I always take your stuff apart and make a book. But is it the page you have in four pieces? It's got four pages?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, well, I won't reread what I read. I started at line number 6 last time with the question, and I read through the answer that occurs on line 20 on that page. But I would continue now for you with the question, when did you realize Royster Clark was not going to fulfill this agreement? Answer, I got a call from Mr. Rainey about the middle of July. Now, I don't, you'll have to tell me, like your colleague was to persuade the chief. To me, it seems, with what I read first and these last few lines that I just pointed out, that Olson thought he had an agreement. Now, that doesn't mean there was an agreement, but it appears to me that he thought he had an agreement.
If you look at this discussion here and the answer, mm-hmm. as was brought up before, that it's really an answer to the question, even if taking into consideration that that is an answer saying, yes, you know, this was the agreement, I think if you look at his prior testimony, he says all along that Mr. Ralston told him that he was just going to work on an agreement.
But that, you know, if I'm looking at the finding of fact of a trial court, now if it's a conclusion of law, maybe it's different, but if I'm looking at a finding of fact, the trial court finds the facts and it can make any inferences as factual findings that are fair game from the testimony. And to me, that seems sufficient to make a finding of fact.
Well, I think you take into account the great weight of the evidence, and I think when you look at the other evidence that is in the testimony, and the fact that this answer, even in its best light, is not answered in the positive, I think you take the testimony as a whole, and you can read that this was something that was going to be worked on, not worked out. You know, there's never any, it would be very easy for Mr. Olson in his testimony to say, yes, we had an agreement. Here's what the agreement was.
People don't always talk like you'd like them to when you get them on the witness stand, though. I'm sure that you're
aware of that.
Yes, that's right. They talk like they do in casual conversation, which is not as precise as would be helpful to all of us.
Well, counsel, looking at the trial judge's decision, page 18, I'm just going to read. Mr. Ralston had been doing business with Olson as a representative of Royster for approximately 18 years and had the authority to make such deals. This is Ralston was making similar deals to orally modify written contracts with other clients. Olson changed its position in negotiating a buyout of the contract and performed the orally modified contract completely. Olson had no knowledge that Ralston did not have the, I quote, actual authority to make this deal until Olson had virtually completed the contract as modified. Now, you find, is that, as far as your position, that is incorrect, that
correct.
Ralston did not have the apparent, or strike that, actual authority.
Correct.
Whether I say apparent authority or actual authority.
Correct.
And where do you point it?
Mr. Ralston's testimony states that he had never told Mr. Olson that he had authority, in fact, that he had told him that he did not. And Mr. Olson's testimony can be used to look at that in another sense to say that he thought he was working on the deal. He obviously, why would he have to work on the deal if he had the authority to make the deal? And I think Mr. Olson's testimony in that regard also affirms what Mr. Ralston had said in his testimony, that he never had the authority and actually had said that he did not have the authority and that he was going to work on meeting with some higher person in his organization to try to come up with a deal.
So that was, you feel, an erroneous finding by the court.
Correct.
Counselor, I note from what we have presented to us that in addition to picking up the 1,700 tons that were remaining of the nitrogen fertilizer, that Olson's also picked up 34.6 more tons. Now, why would they do that if they didn't have some kind of an agreement with Royster Clark?
That was just an agreement that took place. I'm not sure if Mr. Ralston was even a part of that agreement, but that agreement was never part of any of the discussions I had with my client as to what the motives of Olson's were at this point. The idea that they needed more nitrogen fertilizer at that point is, you know, the obvious reason that I could think of. But
they were selling it at a loss at that point in time because they picked it up, you know.
Well, they had not actually paid for that. They had not actually paid for the 34 tons.
I know that.
We did work out afterwards that the price, they would not be selling that at a loss. They sold that for the market price.
I see.
We worked that out before trial. But their motives behind that I do not know.
You don't know. Okay. Thank you very much.
The other position that we have with respect to the Wisconsin statutes goes beyond whether there was an oral agreement here or not. I do not think that there was, obviously, but if there were, there would have to be some agreement, some firm agreement to result in a waiver under Stat 402-209. In this case, they're both sophisticated purchasers. They knew what they were doing, and they knew they'd have to come to an agreement in this case. And according to the contract and according to the statute, they did not do that.
Mr. Hamill, can't you have an agreement that there is going to be one or the other option provided? In other words, as I understand the claim of Olson, it's that either he was going to get credit back or he was going to get free product. Do you have to pin that down before you can have an agreement?
I think you would, Your Honor, and I think the Suzuki case, which was mentioned by the Court of Appeals, goes into what would be needed with respect to an agreement. It said the acts which are relied upon to modify a prior contract must be unequivocal in their character. There has to be some agreement, and as we know with oral contracts, they're never going to contain all the provisions necessary to outline a deal, even in the smallest of transactions.
So you don't think you could have an agreement to one of two options and say you're either going to get one or the other unless you pin it down which option there's no agreement?
I think you could if you came to all the terms of either of those options. In this case, if you from what you're saying with respect to the two options mentioned by Mr. Olson, there were no other terms mentioned other than there were going to be two options, one possibly a rebate, you know, one possibly some free product. Now, if there were terms that were made orally, there was an audio or videotape, or there was some writing, or it was actually done where they'd received product, then I think the two-option scenario may work, may be a waiver under 402-209. But those would have to be more specific. And as the Court also said, acts which are ambiguous in their character and which are consistent either with the continued existence of the original contract or with a modification thereof are not sufficient to establish a modification. So there is some ambiguity in this case for sure, if not no agreement at all.
Thank you.
Counselor, do you agree that this contract falls outside of the statute of frauds under subsection 3 of 402-201 because it was prepaid?
No, I do not believe that it does, and I believe that through the briefing and through the trial court, we all agreed that it was, this case does fall under UCC rules and does fall under 402-209. It's my understanding of the brief of the petitioner here that their question was more of, is this a waiver under 402-209, not whether does this fall under 402-209.
I guess my question was a little bit different. I just want to be sure that you're not concerned that there might be a statute of frauds issue involved with a nitrogen contract.
No, I do not believe that
okay,
there is.
Fine. That's all I wanted to clear up. Thank you. So if this had been an oral agreement, firm, all the terms set, would have been okay?
I believe...
Oral modification.
I believe that can happen under 402-209. I think under the Suzuki case and under Wisconsin knife case, that it says it has to be a very firm agreement. There would have to be terms in place. And some sort of bilateral showing of that. In this case, at best, we have a unilateral testimony to that effect. And I think that really shows why 402-209 is there. Without that statute in place, there would always be discussions about whether people agreed to modify these types of contracts. And if the court, you know, had to sit and judge on all of these types of contracts, it would it'd be very difficult indeed, and it would give one party an option at all times to say, well, we modified this orally, unilaterally. That may be their standpoint, but from another standpoint, the other party did not agree. And I think if you were to allow oral contracts that weren't very firm and there was evidence of them to exist, I think 40209 would be useless. I don't think there would be any point in having it because it's obviously not in writing. It's oral. So I think the purpose of the statute is for this type of case exactly, and it exemplifies why it's needed.
How does the course of dealing of the parties impact on whether there was a waiver under 402-209 sub 4?
I really do not believe it has much of an impact at all. And my feeling on that is in this case there was a contract in place. Now, Royster Clark was obviously in a position where they held a contract with another company and wanted them to fulfill it. Our prior practices with respect to how we dealt with them should not have much of an effect on the way that contract's going to be played out. That's the idea of a contract, to have your terms in writing.
Let me just ask you, in other words, prior practices have very little to do with how this was handled? Maybe I misunderstood what you said.
I think this was handled, particularly this case, was handled as it was throughout Mr. Ralston's career, where he would have to go to somebody else to make an oral adjustment to this type of case. So, yeah, I think it was handled in the way that prior practices would be handled. Now, the question that was asked was, does that have an effect on this type of waiver or oral modification? And I really think it can't have a lot of effect on it unless it can be shown that through that the prior activity, say that a memo would be used or, something unilaterally would be done by one party, which was always done by one party, which always modified that contract, then, you know, there may be something there. But in this case specifically, I don't think the prior acts that are spoke of are really enough to be an oral modification. They don't rise to that level. The prior acts that are mentioned, the testimony are with regard to working out deals when we got into situations like this. Well, that can occur, and that's the business practice of my client to, keep clients to make them happy, but I do not believe they're legally bound to do that, and I don't believe they're legally bound to modify the contract. With respect to reviewing the entire record, in looking at the Court of Appeals decision, I believe they did review the entire record. I think the language that was used was we review Mr. Olson's testimony, not we reviewed Mr. Olson's testimony only. I think it's just a grammatical difference that means we're just looking at his testimony in quotes on this page. Doesn't mean that they did not review the testimony. And I think if you look throughout their opinion, they do refer to what Mr. Ralston had said, refer to what Mr. Rainey had said, and obviously show that they had a firm grasp on what happened in this case and the decision of the court. So I do not believe that is something that should have an effect on this. And even if it did, once again, I would point back to the petitioner's brief. I do not see anything that would have been missed by the Court of Appeals that would sway the decision here. Anything that could have been missed would be harmless error, would be something that does not change anything in this case. There's no red herring out there, Mr. Olson or my client or Mr. Ralston, saying, yes, we did have an agreement. Now, if that were the case, if there was something out there that was completely missed and that was a factual error, that would be a different story. But in this case, that did not occur. I do not believe that is something that should be used to overturn their ruling. I also just looked at a few of the cases that were cited by the petitioner's brief with respect to the Hilkert case, the Gerner case, and the Allen and O'Hara case. Those cases are not similar to the situation we have at hand. I think the Suzuki case that I mentioned before is much more similar, deals with 402-209 and a waiver. In the Hilker case, it was a land contract, not a sale of goods contract. In the Gerner case, the oral agreement that was used to modify was actually performed. So the parties had actually gone through and performed the oral agreement. And in that case, I think 402-209 would certainly come into play and say, you know, there's obvious oral agreement to a written contract in this case, and that could be provided.
Unilateral performance be sufficient to satisfy 402-209-4?
I really don't believe that it can. I think there has to be a showing that it's a bilateral agreement. I think there has to be something that shows both parties came to an agreement. Without that, how can we say there's an agreement? You know, there has to be something on the other party, on behalf of the other party, that goes along with the terms. And I think in a broader sense, there has to be even more than that, because they have to agree on some terms. There has to be some solid terms involved. As I said before, even in the smallest of contracts, details will always be left out in oral agreements. And without that, at this higher burden that 402-209 puts upon parties, that more would be needed.
Nobody has talked much about the rainbow fertilizer, and that's a different contract. It was always oral. The trial court found that its terms were as testified to by Olson and Ralston. Do you want to speak to that? I may ask opposing counsel in rebuttal, but you won't have the chance.
Yeah, I can just speak to the fact that that was an agreement where they had purchased the product initially and continued getting shipments of it.
Mm-hmm.
So they had that would be something orally that they would get another shipment of Super Rainbow. The only reason that product is really a part of this case is because Olson's refused to pay on that bill. I speculate the reason they refused to pay is they felt they were owed money on this nitrogen contract. So in that sense, that's the only reason Super Rainbow ever became a part of this case, and we did settle the amount that was owed before trial on that part of it.
When you say you settled the amount that was owed before trial on that part of it, you determined what the amount would be, win or lose. Either somebody gets an offset or your side gets to be paid for that amount, correct?
Right. That amount was going to be reimbursed regardless of the outcome through either an offset or direct payment to us.
Okay. Does that include the interest component as well or not?
No, it doesn't. And that was another part of our appeal and a part of a portion of the judgment that we believe the judge did not decide correctly. It was, in most cases, interest obviously is not a big portion of it. In this case, there was over $12,000 worth of interest. It was over an extended period of time when Olson's had received the Super Rainbow. We wanted money back on the nitrogen product, so just refused to pay over a few years. Interest was at a rate of 18% pursuant to the credit application. So the interest in this case amounted to quite a bit. So that interest was not decided and was left for the court to decide per agreement before the trial.
All right, good. Thank you. So what do we do about that?
Well, I guess as the Court of Appeals suggested, it be remanded back to the trial court to take a look at whether interest should be provided.
You agree with that?
I agree with that. I agree there has to be basically a hearing to say what the interest would be. There also costs and attorney's fees that were part of the contract and requested as well.
That's the only thing that goes back to the trial court?
Correct.
Pardon me? Yes?
Correct.
Good. Thank you. If in fact we were to agree with the trial court's finding of what that contract was and how it was made, which as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm under a misperception, that they were only obligated to pay for that part of the product that they used, not the entire batch that was mixed up for them. And if that's the case, then would there still be interest due or not?
Yes. Per agreement before trial, we had discussed that the amount that would be due on what they received was $50,000, roughly. But interest was something that we had not decided on. So it may be an issue as to when the interest started. And I think there is an issue as to when interest started as well. So there are some issues with respect to that to be decided.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Justice Prosser?
Are these companies still doing business with each other?
In speaking with my client, there is very little, if any, business done between the parties. At the point where this started, I believe business had started to slow down between the two parties, and there hasn't been a whole lot since, according to my client. That's been part of this litigation.
That they had
that
been,
they really been. Haven't had much of a relationship since then.
They had business dealings for 18 years?
Yes, I believe that it was probably at least that. I think the testimony was that Mr. Ralston had, in fact, had business with Royster for that period of time, or with Olson's for that period of time. And I believe the companies had business relationships even before then.
I think that just to add, it was 40 years, at least in the testimony, 40 years and 18 with Ralston.
That sounds correct. The other issue with respect to bad faith was brought up, and I read through the judge's decision, I really did not see how Royster, in its dealings, in its having a contract with someone and trying to enforce that contract, was dealing in bad faith. I actually went through the transcript and tried to understand how Royster acted in bad faith, and I don't believe that they did. I don't believe that it had a part of its decision, but I think that trying to enforce your contract should not, in any case, not be considered bad faith, but certainly a business dealing, and business dealings are not always pleasant, and when things go wrong, to call that bad faith, I think would be incorrect.
Counselor, under the UCC, Royster Clark had an obligation to mitigate their damages if they thought there was a breach in this contract, didn't they?
Yes, I think they would. I don't know how they would do it in this sense because they already had to deliver the product and receive the money. And that is the strange portion of this case, that it was really about the $50,000 of Super Rainbow where the money portion of this came in. The counterclaim is really the part where Olson's Mill is trying to recover a certain amount. So there was really no way for Royster Clark to mitigate their damages not being able to sell product that was still on hand.
Yeah, so I was thinking about back in the beginning when there was an effort to get out of the contract. But I see what you're saying. You're focusing on the lawsuit.
Right.
Thank you.
And that also gets back to the June 30th date with respect to a possible breach of this contract. I do not believe that date really benefited. It may have benefited Olson in some part, but it was part of the contract to benefit Royster. If Royster had to hold on to this product anymore, they would charge storage fees pursuant to the contract because they obviously, based on the volume of this type of product, holding on to it causes them problems. To suggest that they somehow breached the contract by not having this product picked up by Olson's before that date, I think is disingenuous. And I think we've heard testimony on both sides of that case. Paul Olson testified that at one point he wanted to pick up the product. He couldn't do that. Our company says that they could have picked up the product. But then later, there's a question of whether they actually wanted to receive the product and that they wanted to get this product anymore because of the price difference. So I think it's kind of a red herring. I think it was brought up to show some sort of breach at the trial court level. Was not brought up in the complaint or answer, but I don't believe it had much effect on this contract at all. So I ask that the court of appeals' decision be affirmed. I'd ask that the court find that there is no oral agreement in this case to modify the contract, and if there was an oral agreement to be found, that under 402-209, that it not be allowed in this contract that required a modification in writing, in the statute which requires modification in writing. And I also ask that it be remanded pursuant to the Court of Appeals order to determine whether any interest would be granted on the Super Rainbow contract or any penalties that would apply. Thank you.
Mr. Hamill, I can't help but wonder, and I don't even know if you can answer this, but you're dealing with a client who was working with a party for 18 years. We're talking about a $384,000, as I understand it, dollar contract for 1 year. Is that correct?
Correct.
It would seem to me that given the circumstances, you've already alluded to the fact that there's no dealings now. This would seem to be a valuable client of or valuable customer of your client. This should have perhaps been sat down and worked out a bit differently, or?
Your Honor, I think you're onto something there, but I think there were other factors involved, and I think the Super Rainbow product kind of brings out some of those issues. Olson's Mill received that contract, or received that product in good faith, and refused not to pay it. There were other issues, not part of the record, other issues between the two that were building up. I think their volume of business at that point was already lower than it would have been before this time. So I think it was an end to a relationship, a bitter end, a bad end, but I think that's what happened. Any other questions?
I hear none. Thank you,
Thank
counsel.
You.
Mr. Peoples.
Just a few points that I would like to address here. During Attorney Hamill's argument, a lot of the discussion was about oral contracts and how even the smallest one leaves terms indefinite and they're next to impossible to prove. In this case, I think the agreement, the terms were very clear. Paul Olson would, Olsonsville would pick up the rest of the fertilizer, the fertilizer, and in return he would get the credit either for free product or credited to the amount in the fall.
Didn't he have to pick up the rest of the fertilizer anyway based on the original contract? He had purchased it, he had paid for it. I mean, so why is picking up the rest anything extra? It's something part of a contract that he already had and was obligated, it's already paid for.
I think it goes back to the original conversation that Olson had with Ralston, because at the time they had 700 ton of the 2,000 they had originally purchased. And then based on market conditions and everything, they were seeking to negotiate some way to get out of this contract, to get out of, you know, having to take the rest of this fertilizer and then realizing the substantial loss on this. And then after this discussion is when they said, all right, we'll go ahead, we'll clear out your inventory, we'll take the rest of the product, we'll move it as best we can, and then in return they would get the credit for the free product or an offset for their fall purchase, and the price, the amount of that credit would have been determined after they had sold the rest of the fertilizer. Now, Royster also benefited from this deal, because throughout Ralston's and Olson's testimony, based on the market conditions, a lot of customers were coming in, canceling contracts and getting out and not getting the product that they had ordered. Both sides benefited. Olson got
the credit. Counsel, I'm sorry, but you say this agreement is clear, and once again, I look at pages 100 and 101, and maybe I'm missing something, but the language, and in fact, the trial court stopped him at this point. What he was going to try to get a credit when we refilled in the fall of either material or price concession on the number of times we bought. And then the court interrupts and said, wait a minute, let me hear that again. And he starts again on 101. He was going to work to either give us free product or reduce the price per ton of product. Now, I look at the remainder of that page, and I know that Justice Rodenzak has alluded to that page a number of times, and I note where agreement shows up. And it kind of reminds me of a commercial that's on television right now for a show called Conviction, where a young prosecutor is asking a number of questions, and the judge jumps in and says, sustain, 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 but judge, there's no objection. And he points to the bailiff and says, and the bailiff responds, you can't lead on direct. The only time agreement shows up on page 101 is from the attorney, never from the witness. I never see agreement anywhere from the witness here.
Well, I believe answer to that, that based on, again, I'm going to go back to the long business history and the fact that Olson changed her position from negotiating a buyout and getting out from this contract to turning right around and picking up the contract, that the fruits from this discussion with the sales agent in June were more than just, well, I promise to try to see what I can do. It's like, no, this is what's going to do, and based on the past business dealing and history, these types of discussions have always borne fruit. They have never, and it was directly from Roger Ralston's testimony and from Paul Olson, that they have never had this problem before. They have never had a negotiation to modify a contract. They have never had their discussions a month after the fact. All of a sudden, nope, it's no good, you're stuck. I think that is key when you look at the testimony comprehensively and you look at the whole history between the parties, that this is more than just two random strangers walking down the street. That would be a different story if saying, hey, if you do this, I'll see what I can do for you, as opposed to, hey, I've been doing business for you, with you, this particular sales agent for 18 years and with this company for 40. Hey, here's the problem, market bottomed out, what can we do? Okay, let's do this. They do it. A month later, no, no go. And I think it's indicative of Robert Rainey himself, who was the new actor in this. He's the change of circumstances. He was the new supervisor that was there less than a year. And essentially what we have, the parties address the situation like they always have in the past, but then the new supervisor, who was not familiar with the situation, changed the rules of the game midstream. And that's why we're here today. Thank you.
Mr. Hamill, and thank you, Mr. Peoples, for your very good arguments in this case. That concludes 038P1534, Royster Clark, Inc. versus Olson's Mill, Inc. The court will meet at the conference at 3 o'clock. We are in recess until tomorrow at 9:45.